Okay, if you've been in our classes, we know that you should know that we've gone through Revelation chapter 12. We're ready for Revelation 13. And this is going to be a major change in some things. It builds on Revelation chapter 12. So usually don't take a full class to introduce some things, but in this particular case, this is what I'd like to do. You may remember back there in Revelation chapter 12 that we talked about the foes of the church. We saw that John introduced the image of a woman, and that image was initially used to describe all the things in the Old Testament that led up to the birth of the Messiah. And Satan wanted to go ahead and destroy the Lord. We talked about some of his various attempts, but he failed. And then, now that Jesus has come into the world, he's established his church. Since Satan wasn't able to stop it, what's he doing? All right, he's trying to, you know, interfere with it and destroy it at every opportunity that he has. So we could look at Revelation chapter 12 and describe that as, you know, the foes of the church. Well, Satan failed. So in Revelation 13, it's kind of like the devil. He's pictured as going to the sand of the sea, and he puts out the call for help. Now, we might not ever think that Satan is enlisting or trying to enlist helpers, but this is precisely the picture in Revelation 13. Let's just look at the first verse. And he stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns 10 diadems or crowns, and upon his heads names of blasphemy. Now some think this is John. I think a better explanation is that we're dealing with the devil. The devil's there, he's looking for assistance. Now we've said, and we've seen this as we look through the book, we've said that for these readers, what was a great source of discomfort and persecution in the first century? What authority did they live under? The United States? They lived under Rome. And when you look at Roman history, and you can see this on the second sheet that you have, and we'll make reference to this. You go through and you start looking at the emperors beginning with about 50 years before Christ and going up to about 337. Now, I didn't count them up, but a little over half of them, I'd say, looking at the sheet. When you look at them, they were persecutors of Christians. And not just a little bit. I mean, we're talking about significant persecution from these guys. So you might look at one of those blank spots, and sometimes you don't have very long between a persecutor and then no persecution, and then the next guy comes along and the next emperor is involved with persecution. Even if you don't have persecution from the state, if you will, what about your local area? I mean, local government can sometimes be just as bad, maybe even worse, than the state. So it was a great period of persecution for Christians, and we've seen this throughout the book. Way back when we were looking at the introductory material, we talked about the power of evil Rome, and then even as early as Revelation 2:10, remember, be thou faithful unto death. Well, what do you think was going to take the lives of people? Persecution. So right there in Revelation 2, verse 10, we saw it in Revelation 2, verse 13 in chapter 6, where John talked about the second seal. We showed how the second seal is related to persecution, Revelation 6, verses 9 through 11. The fifth seal is also related to persecution, Revelation 8, verses 7 through 9. The first two trumpets also deal with persecution, Revelation 11, verses 7 and 8. Recent material. Revelation 12, verse 13, also recent material. So throughout this book, throughout the culture, persecution, 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 persecution. So when we come to Revelation 12, Revelation 13, and the chapters that follow, this is still going to be a major theme. So we're going to see some of the details in the book that are understood differently by people, but this is one of the things that we have to keep in mind. A lot of people believe that John, I think there's almost universal agreement, in the first part of Revelation 13, John talks about this beast. There is, among interpreters, almost universal agreement that John was talking about ancient Rome. But once you get beyond that point, then people have some different ideas. And in the class, I'm going to try to give you what I think is the best view and also lay out some of the alternatives. But to go ahead and, like I say, I could be wrong in the way that I approach some of the information in this particular chapter. I think it's unwise to be overly dogmatic, but I'm going to do the best I can with it, and you can take what I offer. Don't take it as gospel, if you will, as far as the big point is right, as far as the persecution. But in some of the smaller details, like I say, I could be incorrect about that, so bear that in mind, and we'll try to make that clear as we look at some alternatives. When you think about government, is it designed in God's eyes to hurt people or help people? Designed to help. You know, Paul makes that clear in Romans 13, verses 1 through 4. He says, government has been ordained by God, and it's designed to do good. But when you look at the things that God has designed for people, Where's the devil?
Right in the middle.
He's right in the middle of it. And he says, well, okay, God's done this. He's made this. But what am I going to do? I'm going to try to corrupt it. I'm going to try to pervert it. I'm going to try to, you know, twist it. Well, when we think about government, how powerful is it? I mean, you know, where people live, I mean, generally that is the power. So it makes perfect sense for the devil to try to corrupt or twist or somehow take that force and change it. Now, that's one of his great tools. What's the other great power that he has? You take the government and you also take religion. If you can get both of those, if you're the devil, how much success are you going to have? I mean, you've got, you know, they talk about some card games. You've got, you know, for example, euchre, you've got the right and left bower, two most powerful cards. Well, that's how you might think of the devil as he goes through the world. He's, you know, if he can get civil government on his side and he can get religion on his side. And John, most I think, would also agree on this point that John talks about two beasts in Revelation chapter 13. And they may not, like I say, be completely agreed on the second one, but they think the first one is Rome. And they believe that the second one describes some kind, some type, some form of religion. Now, Daniel has some information that is related to what we find here in Revelation chapter 13. If you were to go back to the book of Daniel, you'd find the symbols that John uses in Revelation chapter 13. What are the three animals that he has? He says this beast, which we'll talk about a little bit more, and as I said, most people understand this as Rome. He says the beast was like, it was as, it was similar to what animals? A leopard, a bear, and a lion. And when you go back and you look at Rome, this was a very, very good illustration for Rome. Daniel, as you look at the other sheet that was passed out, Daniel 2, you may remember that Nebuchadnezzar has this particular image. And as you go back, I think most of us have studied it at various times. Daniel 2, verse 38 says that there was a head of gold. And if you don't remember, it's on the sheet. You can cheat. What was the head of gold going to represent? It's right there on the sheet. All right, well, the lion, and in between the head and the lion, you've got the nation of Babylon. And then you move down to the next part of the image. You've got the breast and the arms of silver, and that stood for the Persian or the Medo-Persian Empire. And then in Daniel 7, you're going to see that symbolized as a bear. Babylon, of course, the head of gold, Daniel 7, it is designated as a lion. And then we come down to the third kingdom. And here, of course, we have the belly, the brass belly. We've got the thighs. And what does that stand for representing Daniel's image? We've got the Grecian kingdom, which in Daniel 7 is compared to a leopard. And then we finally get down to the bottom of the image, and we've got those legs. And there, Daniel 2:39 says that they ruled over all the earth, going to be strong as iron, Daniel 2, verse 40. And what do the legs represent? They represented Rome. All right, and then you've got the information about the little stone, God's kingdom, and so forth. Sometimes people think, well, there's a fifth kingdom there, the toes. But if you go back and you look at what Daniel said, the toes are not identified as a fifth kingdom. They're simply identified as being part of that fourth kingdom instead of comprising a fifth kingdom. Then, as we mentioned, God promised that he was going to set up a kingdom in those days, that is, in the days of that last kingdom. Well, you think about history, how it unfolded, what Daniel describes. You've got the kingdom of Babylon. Some time passes. The Medes and the Persians come into power. Some time passes. The Greeks, they come into power. Finally, Rome comes into power. That's the power in Jesus' day. And was a kingdom set up during the time of Rome? Sure. You know, Jesus, remember Mark 9, verse 1, before some of you die, what's going to be established? The kingdom of God. Now, there had been some important worldly kingdoms, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. But God's kingdom, remember John 18, I think it's verse 36, Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. So it was going to be unlike those earthly kingdoms, but it was going to be established in the time of Rome. And it was. Jesus, John the Baptist, they both come on the scene. They're preaching, and they say, repent. Why? Because the kingdom of God is at hand. It's imminent. It's going to be established. And once again, it was not going to be a physical, it was not going to be an earthly kingdom. And in the New Testament, we read about this kingdom being established. Acts 8:12 talks about a preacher. He was preaching good tidings concerning the kingdom of God. Colossians 1:13 talks about people being translated into the kingdom. We receive a kingdom that can't be shaken. Hebrews 12, verse 28. So John, in Revelation 13, is drawing from this information. Daniel saw this beast back there And then that's developed in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 if you want to go back and look at it at sometime that's convenient for you. All right, Daniel. Well, I'm going to omit that. John's readers, as they would have looked at their situation in their day and time, you know, Rome, we've talked about, and we've seen some of this on the VBS videos, how Rome treated them. If you were under that kind of oppressive government, which what word would be appropriate? Would beast be appropriate? People sometimes say when they're dealing with someone, he's a monster. Well, not literally. But they do that to describe great oppression. They do that to describe great hurt and so forth. So when John's readers would have looked at what he wrote here, the beast, I think the first thing that would have come to their mind would have been Rome. Then you have this point as well. When you look at people like the apostles and some of the others who had spiritual gifts, that inspiration, if you will, that they possessed, do you think that would have allowed them to go back to the Old Testament scriptures and teach some pretty interesting Bible classes? I mean, if God is directing your thoughts and your ability to teach, you're an inspired teacher. Think you could sort through the book of Daniel fairly easily in a Bible class?
Yeah.
Sure. You know, Paul did that with the Old Testament, not necessarily the book of Daniel, but he went into the synagogues and he began to unfold. He began to take those Old Testament passages and began to show them how. You know, even in Acts chapter 8, remember? You've got Philip. He's riding along with the eunuch. The eunuch is reading Isaiah 53. And, you know, Philip comes up and says, "You understand what you're reading?" And the guy's kind of scratching his head. Well, not really. And beginning with this scripture, what did Philip do? He began to preach Jesus. Well, he is an example of that. And surely the same kind of thing happened many, many other times in the first century. So the stuff that we're looking at was more than likely also being looked at in the first century. Notice, if you will, a little later in Revelation 13, verse 7. Anybody want to read that passage for us? Revelation 13, 7. All right, Steve.
"It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him on every tribe, tongue, and nation."
Okay. Now, when you think about that, authority over every tongue, every tribe, every nation. If you were in the first century and you were reading this, what kind of light bulb would be going off in the head? Who's he talking about? Who's got authority over everybody?
Rome.
I mean, it just seemed like Rome literally controlled the world. And, you know, when you go back and you look, we've, as I said, seen this in some of the VBS videos. We've talked about it. As those people went from, you know, various community to various community, what did they see as far as religious? You know, they see a building that said Church of Christ on every corner, like you do down in Nashville? Probably not. What religious buildings did they see? Did they see religious structures? Yes. But who were they for? The pagans, the emperors, you know, they were the gods in the first century world. So, you know, here's the place where you can honor the emperor. You know, here's a statue over here of this kind of emperor. So some of these guys were actually deified after death. All right, now, a lot of information about Rome, and as I said, almost universal agreement on this point. Then we come down midway through the chapter, and like I say, I want to sort through this as far as introductory material, so when we go back through it again, it may be a little easier to process. Verse 11 says, "And I saw what? Another beast." Bad enough for that first monster back there in Revelation chapter 1. And John, of course, as you look at these two beasts or two monsters back there in verse 1, he says, "The first beast that comes up out of the sea." Now in verse 11, he says, "This other beast, where's it come from?" This one comes from where? Okay, it comes from the earth. Sounded like somebody said air. And we don't want that answer. It's coming up from the earth. It's coming up from the land. And then also, unlike the first beast, that one, verse 1, had 10 horns. And remember, 10 is a word for completeness, fullness. The second beast has only two horns. And I think, and once again, here's a place where we're having to do a little interpretation. And, you know, I could be wrong. Others could be wrong. Maybe I'm right. But my thinking is that when we think about this second beast, it's got two distinct aspects of power. You have, of course, the religious element, which we're going to see and which we can point out this morning. And also there seems to have been some association with civil power. Notice from verse 11, a couple things, then we'll also look at verse 13 and then over in chapter 16, verses 13 and 14. "And I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and it had two horns like unto a lamb, and he spake as a dragon." Well, let's sort out some of the details there. If it's speaking as a dragon, what does that tell us?
Evil.
All right, it's evil. Isn't it Revelation 12:9 where we have that same reference to a dragon. And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he's called the devil. So when we back up to Revelation 12, and we look here in Revelation 13, 11, if he's speaking as the dragon, he's really a mouthpiece for the devil and his work. So we know he's evil. But then John says something else about this second beast. Notice the other point. He says he was like a
lamb.
Well, when we think about religion, what does the image of a lamb symbolize or suggest?
A lamb and sheep.
Well, okay. You think about that. Anything else? Well, okay, Christ comes to mind, but maybe even something more fundamental than that. Sacrifice. Religion, sacrifice, lambs. I mean, when you look at the very sacrifice, lambs. So with that image of sacrifice, you have here in Revelation 13, verse 11, the indication that you have some kind of religion, but it is an evil religion, it is a corrupt religion, it's something contrary to what God wants. And then look at verse 13. And he, that is this second beast that's religious plus evil, he does what? He does great signs. Well, this is, again, one of the things that complicates for us what John is describing. How does this evil... Well, first of all, we have to kind of figure out what this evil beast is. And then after we do, how is he able to perform, or this movement, whatever it is, how is this person or how is this movement able to perform miracles? Well, I think one of the first things that we would conclude would be this. Would the miracles be legitimate or illegitimate? They would not be of God. At least we can say that. Somehow Satan was involved with them, whether they were actual power or maybe they were things like ventriloquism, whatever it was, that they're fake miracles. So at least we can be assured of that much. And then over in chapter 16, verses 13 and 14, and I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits, as it were frogs. For they are spirits of demons, working signs which go forth unto the kings of the whole world, to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. And then, of course, you get into Armageddon in verse 16, and we're not going to bite that off today. But just to let you know that additional information is given here about this particular religious beast. Now, as I said earlier at the beginning of the class, it is unwise to be overly dogmatic here. There are people who have a lot of different ideas about this, and I could be wrong about some or little or all of what we're going to go through. So that's why I said we want the big picture, good versus evil. No doubt about that point. Rome definitely seems to be the first beast. Almost no doubt about that particular point. But now when we deal with the second beast and so forth, there are a couple of leading ideas. The one that I favor, and again, I could be wrong about this, but I'm going to approach this from the standpoint of the second beast being the Holy Roman Empire. Now, if you have not looked at, and I don't claim to be an expert in history, but as you go back and you look at history, you've got the kingdoms that we talked about, you've got Babylon, you've got Medo-Persia, you've got the Greeks, you've got Rome. And after about 500 years, in about 476, Rome fell. But there came a time when, Rome was revitalized, raised up, if you will. Anybody know what caused Rome to kind of, be resurrected? Well, think about what we said earlier. You've got two powers that sometimes have worked hand in hand. You've got civil power, and you've got that other power of religion. Now, if you have an apostate state that joins with an apostate church that has a lot of power, it's going to pose some problems for those who are trying to do what's right. And like I say, I'm going to go back and review some things with you. If I'm wrong, as far as applying what we now know as Catholicism, and it took a while to evolve into that, even if I'm wrong about the interpretation, there's some history here. And I'm not trying to beat up on the Catholics or anything like that, but there's some history here that a lot of people either, I think, don't study that often or they've forgotten, which should be interesting, and I think it's helpful to know. One source that has done a lot of research in this area described the papacy in this way. He said, "No other than the ghost of the deceased Roman Empire sitting crowned upon the grave thereof. For so did the papacy start up on a sudden out of the ruins of that heathen power." Now, that's an interesting statement, and it kind of summarizes what I'm trying to suggest. Rome, and it was well after John had died, but Rome As you go back and look at history, it does join with an apostate church, and it's just like Rome rises from the dust. He went on to say that Emperor Constantine, he was quote-unquote converted. A lot of people talk about Constantine's conversion, but he didn't become a Christian in the sense that we think of it. But he quote-unquote converted to Christianity in 312 AD, and at that point the bishops joined the bureaucrats to form a new governing class in the empire. The bishops of Italy became the heirs of the Roman Senate. Now think about that. The bishops of Italy became the heirs of the Roman Senate. Once again, when you start to take religion and you mix it with the political realm, I mean, you're controlling two very, very important aspects of people's lives. I mean, if you can get control of one, it's significant. But if you can control both, it really has significance. He said the bishops of Italy became the heirs of the Roman Senate. The bishop of Rome became the emperor's successor. Think about that. The bishop of Rome became the emperor's successor. Catholic bishops use monks as terrorists to enforce their rule. So once again, as you go back at history, in history, and this stuff is information that actually happened, you've got some terrible, terrible things happen. In the Middle Ages, if you go back and you look at that time, the apostate religion was really the only force that was strong enough to provide the kind of leadership to do the kinds of things that we read. We studied some of this back in Revelation chapter 11, verses 7 through 8, and also verses 9 through 10. And as you look at history, you kind of go up through time. In the 15th century, the same source went on to note that the 12 gods of ancient Rome had been replaced by the cults of the 12 apostles, whose relics could, and we'll say a little bit more about this, but they came to a point where they thought these church relics that we even hear about today, they could cure diseases, they could control the weather, and inflict harm on those who opposed them. When we were talking about the Dark Ages before, remember I talked about the ignorance? The Bible was being chained to the pews, and it was just a great state of spiritual darkness. And that actually happened. Another quick quote, the false worship of Diana during the time of pagan Rome was replaced, in this author's words, by the so-called Queen of Heaven, Mary. By the time of the 16th century, people were claiming that through the saints, people, St. Michael or St. so-and-so, that through these people, they could prevent lightning from striking. They could restore sight to the blind. Or they could preach to birds and fish. Unencumbered by the limitations of time and space, they could do even more through their images and relics after death. A pious glance at the statue of St. Christopher in the morning ensured protection from illness and death throughout the day. Now think about that. Looking at a statue, looking at an image, people were led to believe that this could go ahead and protect them throughout the day. And then during the Middle Ages too, people, when it came time for the Lord's Supper, if the bread was quote-unquote consecrated, and we've seen some of these same kinds of claims today, the bread could bleed. There were claims about the bread levitating, just rising right off the table with no human intervention. It could transform itself under the likeness of Christ and protect itself from impious hands. And you begin to go back and you see some of the things that, came out of the Holy Roman Empire and some of the stuff that's even today. It's real tempting to go back, and when John writes this stuff, to not make a connection. And not everybody takes this approach. Several do. And this is going to be the way that I approach at least some of what's in Revelation. Now, if you think about that last point that I just made, here's the Lord's Supper that's being passed. And because of the claims during this time, the idea is that impious hands can't touch it. What would that mean in a local congregation? I pass the bread to Steve, and he's got good hands, he's got a good heart, and then he passes it over to Lois, and she's got impious hands, so what happens to her? Well, maybe the plate won't pass. Or maybe she tries to reach for the bread. It just stays away from her. Can you imagine that kind of claim? I mean, today we'd say, well, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But that actually, historically, was one of the things that happened. And then somebody says, well, that was a long time ago. Think about what is claimed today. If you have the host, if you will, they're the bread, and it is, quote unquote, blessed by the priest, they speak that formula, what do they claim happens to it? All right, it goes from being bread to literally the flesh of Christ. Well, if that were true, wouldn't it be a miracle? I mean, I don't think there'd anybody that would be denying that, and certainly the Catholic faith would also be affirming that as well. As you go back and you think about, and most of us, I think, are old enough to have come across some of these claims, we've seen claims about paintings crying, haven't we? Anybody remember some of those? You've got a work of art, maybe over in Rome or somewhere else, and there's a picture of Mary, and they actually say she's shedding tears. Statues bleeding, apparitions, the casting out of demons. Today, You know, how many are familiar with the Catholic Church and their claims of exorcism? You know, we've all heard that. So when you begin to see this apostasy, and this is one of the things, it's not like some other groups that have been around, 100 or 200 years that are contrary to Christ. When you go back and you see this stuff, I mean, for over 1,000 years, it was used to keep God's people in the dark and deceive people about miracles and some other stuff. And even today, you still have the remnant of this kind of stuff. So because of the long history, if the book of Revelation describes things that take place throughout the Christian era, it to me is not surprising, for John, according to this view, to have at least made some kind of allusion to these kinds of things. There are some other claims that are just really outrageous. If you go back and you look at some of what's been claimed, Catholicism has said that there are some bodies, and these would be of the holy people, that don't experience corruption. Now, can you imagine that? A body, today we talk about embalming, but a body that was a person that was so holy, their body doesn't decay. And this is, like I say, one of the things that has been suggested. It's a doctrine of incorruptibility. When you go back and you look at history, you also find the Crusades. A lot of people are familiar with that time. Anybody remember whether or not there was a religious power involved with the Crusades? Oh, yeah. You go back and you look at the popes. They're right there with the Crusades. They, and we saw this in the Dave Miller videos about Islam. One of the big complaints about Islam is that how they were so mistreated by the Catholics. And there was mistreatment of the Muslims or of the Islamic faith by people. But were they Christians? They were Catholics. So Islam has associated that word Christian with the wrong group. But there were some battles that were waged. Some have compared the campaigns to robbery, massacre in the name of religion, and popes really motivated these holy wars by promising wealth to people. And two, this was the time where, hey, if you didn't convert to Catholicism, what happened to you? All right, you're put to death. You're killed. So once again, it's history that a lot of people just sometimes kind of pass off, but from a religious standpoint, very, very important. And when John talks about the kind of power here, it fits in very well with the kind of power that we've seen throughout time with the Catholic Church. In addition to that, what about the Spanish Inquisition? You go back, that started about 1478, went through about 1834. You've got a king. You've got the monarchs of Spain, the king and the queen. They wanted to create a unified country. And they thought, well, we're going to create a unified country, but how are we going to do it? We need the power of, once again, you got the state. We need the power of the church. We need the power of religion. So what faith do you think they chose to embrace? All right. What we now refer to as the Catholic faith. So they went back, they asked permission from the Pope to start an Inquisition. Let's go out there and let's find the folks who are not true blue committed Catholics. And when we go out and find them, if a person is accused of heresy, guess what's going to happen? We're going to bring them before some kind of tribunal, and they're going to go ahead and possibly be executed. They were put into dungeons, dark dungeons infested with vermin. Some faced executions. And when you go back and you look at the torture methods, I didn't think I was going to deal with these, and maybe I'll not get too specific, but I've got a little more time than I had thought. When you go back and you look at the torture methods, at least in my mind, these things were so horrific that not even non-religious people would use them. But you imagine a religious group that is supportive of the kinds of things that I'm going to mention to enforce their faith. We've all heard of the rack, right? What was a rack? All right, hands tied, feet tied, and then you get stretched. You go from 5'8" to 6'2". Well, probably not literally. But that would go ahead and dislocate a person's arms, and virtually every joint in the body would have been dislocated. Then there was another, I'm going to pronounce it the strapido. They would go ahead and wrists and arms would be tied up. You'd be elevated a little bit, and then you'd be dropped. But when you were dropped, it would be bad if your feet hit the floor, but your feet didn't touch the floor when you were dropped. So just be, imagine raising somebody up 6, 8, 10 feet, and bang, they drop you. Well, and then, you're kind of hanging right there. And if that didn't do enough to destroy the body, they would also go ahead and sometimes put weights on the feet of people to inflict even more damage. You can go back and do some things as far as Google searches and torture methods of the Spanish Inquisition, but it's too close to lunch to tell you what was involved with this. But they would sometimes take a funnel, put it in a person's mouth, and force 30 pints of stuff into a person's stomach. Now, that was, you know, Kool-Aid or water or something. Teresa and I are trying to juice right now. I think that may be better for health. And some of that stuff make a billy goat sick that we're drinking. But, you know, as bad as some of the stuff is that we're ingesting, it doesn't compare with the things that I'm not going to describe that were fed through this funnel. But regardless, it was nasty going down, just absolutely disgusting things. But what happens when you put that much stuff into a person's stomach? It's going to rupture. It's going to burst. It's going to kill them. So once again, when you think about Catholicism and how it was being, quote-unquote, promoted during this time, the people who were not willing to convert, this was one of the things that was done. There was another thing that was sometimes done. A person's legs and arms were broken. And then if you can imagine a large platform that was hoisted in the air, and then, you know, person once have had their bones broken in that kind of way, arms, legs, feet, and so forth, they can't move. And then they just let the buzzards come and eat them. Now, can you imagine a religious group persecuting people, you know, to get them into an apostate faith, and once they are not willing to convert, you know, this is the kind of thing that takes place. Sometimes people, and this may not have been the most brutal kind of torture, immediately, but long term, suspend them in a big cage like a bird cage and just watch them die. Just literally let them rot away. And then, of course, you know, some were roasted to death, and I mean, it just was a very, very bad thing. So when you begin to go back and you look at some of the history, and I just really only kind of scratched the surface on some of these things, and there were some other items as well. Can you imagine a pope claiming that he's greater than the president? This was one of the claims that was made by the popes. They said when it came to the emperor, there's you, there's me, and who's the guy that's on top? The pope. Well, that is logical if you think about what Catholicism has claimed. I mean, if he's the vicar of Christ, well, it would naturally follow that who's going to be the most important one? It's got to be the pope instead of the emperor. So when you have this great nation of Rome, and you've got someone at some point, and there was not just one, but you've got some people coming along at various points and saying, hey, you know, we are the one. It's just absolutely amazing. Once again, in my mind, it would not be surprising for John, even though some of these things didn't come to pass exactly in his lifetime, for him to make mention of these kinds of things in the book of Revelation. Now, having said that, let me say this. Have there been other kingdoms, other nations, other powers throughout time that have been hurtful to God's people? Absolutely. No doubt about that. You go back and you look at some of the things that China has done. You go back and you look at some of the persecution that Soviet Russia, caused people to endure. But out of all that, I mean, several nations have been bad. But when you go back and you look at Rome, there is 1,000 years of history which shows just repeated persecution of God's people. And even today, you can name any denomination, and it still does not have the kind of pull. Anybody see in the last day or two news about the Pope, quote unquote? I mean, he's all over the news, various things. So, even the power that is exercised by this religious group is, phenomenal by today's standard. Let's see, I've got a couple more things to say. I picked up as I was looking at some of the things about this 13 years ago. January 13th, 2000, there was an edition in the Wall Street Journal, and it talked about how Rome's airport, I've never been there. But at least at that time, if you were going through Rome's airport, you could actually pursue an indulgence. There's a chapel in Rome's airport, and during the year 2000, you could buy an indulgence. If you think back to Catholic history and Catholic, an indulgence, they claimed that was not to, allow you to sin. But in an indulgence, they came in two different varieties. In the full, the plenary indulgence was basically, let me back up a bit. Catholic thought, sin will cause you to go where? Well, it's going to send you to hell, but purgatory. And purgatory in Catholic thought is that place where what happens? All right, you make it, you make things right. You spend some time there, you suffer, and then after you've paid the price for the sins, then you're able to go on into glory and go on into heaven. All right, the indulgences. Let's say that you, potluck today and somebody says, well, hey, that's the greatest casserole ever, and you lie. And you feel bad about that. So you would buy an indulgence. And that indulgence would allow you, if it was the right kind of indulgence, it would allow you to not spend any time in purgatory for that lie about the casserole. Rome's airport was actually, in 2000, selling that kind of indulgence. I don't know how much it cost. And the chaplain there in the airport said, well, you know, why go to Rome? You know, you can even do this less than an hour. You can even do it in between flights. Now, can you imagine the audacity of a religious group that would do that within 13 years of today's date? Now, to me, that's just off the chart. So when we talk about the Catholic Church, again, I'm not trying to beat up on them, but at the same time, there is some history there that a lot of people don't know about. They fit very well with the second beast. Now, there are some alternative explanations. If you want to relate this to something that was in the first century, when you look at Rome, we know about the false religion that we've talked about at various times, and I'll mention this again likely next week as we actually get into the text. They had enforcers. And we would, I think, expect that. The emperors, as far as the religion, they knew that not everybody was willing to go along with that. So sometimes people just need some prodding. So there was what's often referred to as a little cult. And the, I guess you would refer to them as religious priests. They went around and they enforced the religion in various ways. Now that may also be part of John's point. Some think that that is the sole point. When he talks about this second religious beast causing them to pay attention to Rome and so forth. And that very well, as I said, could be part of the point. But whether or not that's the sole point, at this point, you know, in my life, I have some reservations about that. So I, as I mentioned, kind of favor the view that what we're dealing here ultimately became the Holy Roman Empire. But once again, I could be wrong. But at least we'll get some, I think, important history as we go through this study. Anything that you want to add or ask based on what we said for our introductory comments? Scott?
With the government and religion coming together being so powerful, it could be in a bad way. I mean, it kind of makes you understand why there's such a battle in America about that. So, I mean, if the government, you know, chooses one religion, that's not the religion that you want.
And there have been various cultures that have gone through that very kind of thing. A religion is selected and picked, and then it's either you do this or you're going to face some consequences. And you begin to see at the end of Revelation 13, and this really kind of takes us, I guess if we're doing kind of an overview, it's not going to hurt. Let's skip down to 16, Revelation 13, 16. And he causeth how many? All. The small, the great, the rich, the poor, the free, the bond that were... that there be given unto them a mark in the right hand or upon their forehead, and that no man should be able to do what? Buy or sell. And then verse 18 is going to talk about the mark of the beast, which that should be a really, really interesting class. But that's a couple weeks out. So here you have a situation. It was either you do what John regarded as apostate, or the consequence is, what's going to happen? You're going to suffer economically. You're not going to be able to buy or sell. So you do have that kind of situation. Then you also have this issue. Let's suppose that the reverse were to occur. Let's say that we have a sort of set of circumstances where there is a government and it decides to embrace New Testament Christianity. It does exactly what's right. So you've got a government that tries to do what's right. You've got a government that is also trying to follow the Bible. Would you not still have some issues? What about the people that don't want to obey? That becomes very difficult for the government. From a New Testament perspective, you'd have to say people have free will. But from a government's perspective, that becomes difficult. Well, yes, you know, you can have free will, but at the same time, while we try to observe that religious truth, how are we going to be able to deal with some other things? So whichever side of the fence a government would be on, whether it's a true faith or an apostate faith, there are going to be some significant issues. So in one sense, when the U.S. was set up, it wasn't freedom from religion, it was freedom of religion, recognizing that religion was important, but at the same time trying to get away from some of the problems of the past, and that was basically a state-sponsored church, that you either have to do this or you're going to have some problems. Stan?
Back in verse 11, that phrase, like a lamb, you may be one of the most understated statements in the whole scripture. If you look at verse 13, it says he doeth great wonders. Verse 14, and he deceiveth them. It seems to me like when he says, like a lamb, he may simply be saying, a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yes, and I think that's exactly the kind of thing that Jesus talked about in Matthew 7. They look so right, so religious, and so good, and they will tear you up spiritually. So you're exactly correct. And it looked good. Steve?
If you think about it, it's just all about money.
Well, such was also true for the two things that we've talked about today. When you look at Rome, you know, you're paying, and we'll talk a little bit more about this at a later time, but they were paying, you know, pinch a little incense to Caesar, buy some incense, and then you'll be able to get married, and you'll be able to buy and sell, and you'll be able to get a will and all these other things. And it was about money. You know, the temples were not free. There were some services that had to be paid for. And when you look at Catholicism, anybody ever seen some of the pictures that relate to the Pope, some of his clothing, the places, the artwork that they have? Where do you think they got that? It didn't come from Walmart. I mean, when you have people buying the indulgences and everything else, I mean, you've got money. And we'll talk about this too, but you've probably heard the old saying, when the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. So basically, and today you can, you know, Catholicism, you find people, they light candles for folks. You think they're just passing out candles and matches for free? If you want to light a candle after a Catholic service, I can almost guarantee you that you're going to pay for it. So once again, you've got that connection. Ancient Rome, modern Catholic, and there's some other groups, obviously. I don't want to limit that to those two, but you're exactly right. And with the government, the same kind of thing. Bessie?
I read in the past, years ago, that smaller countries that predominantly Catholic said, you'll notice that they're very poor because they are required to give so much to the Catholic Church that they can hardly sustain themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a religion that has a lot of money coming into it. And yeah, and when you look at what they have and, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and the people who have seen what most people are not able to see, I mean, it's just a literally treasure trove of precious artwork and some other things. Bonnie, and then I'll take Marcia.
I have an uncle that passed away in 99, and my aunt is my mom's sister, and they're Catholic. A year ago, my cousin told me that her mom was still paying to have my uncle out of purgatory.
Yeah. Our family, Teresa and I, we've got that same kind of situation that has occurred. I think it's been stopped now, but the same kind of thing. And I mean, it's just a steady stream of income because of that. And when you go back and you look, I think I'm a little off, but I believe right now that we've got about 62 million Catholics. I don't know if that's worldwide. I think that's worldwide. But that's a lot of folks. And when you look at the reach of this particular religious group, it is absolutely distinctive as far as the past history and today. So once again, it may not have been in John's mind, but I'm going to do some relating to this, what became this religious faith and what we have here in the book of Revelation. Marcia.
I was just going to say something similar to what Jessica said. 46 years ago, I toured Spain and Portugal, and I was in tours where beautiful, gorgeous
Well, the Orthodoxy, the Greek Orthodoxy group, is tied into all that as well. And if you go back and you look at, you know, Jenny has seen some of those, I'm sure, and I've seen some of them, and it's the same kind of deal. People, I mean, they have one set of clothes if they're lucky. Maybe one halfway decent meal a day. And yet you go back and you look at the religious groups, ornate, and I mean, all kinds of money has been invested. Yeah, it really is. So, like I say, I think it's consistent with what John wrote, but we also want to exercise that word of caution.